I say the purpose of election audits is to convince everybody who isn't a nut that the loser lost. Okay, so that raises the question, what's a nut? So I'm going to do this not soup to nuts, but nuts to soup. What's a nut? So a nut is somebody whose biggest fear is different enough from yours, right? Somebody who shares your biggest fear is sane and smart. Somebody whose biggest fear is close to yours has an interesting perspective. From there we go to, eccentric, preoccupied, irrationally fixated, and finally nuts, right? And the Wayne's World test, which can I say in this company, is if when you hear somebody's biggest fear and you think, could happen, and monkeys could fly out of my butt, that person's nuts, right? All right, so what good is a risk-limiting audit? That's the general topic here. Well, it helps convince the non-nuts that the loser's lost. It's not the end of the story, but it is one piece of the puzzle. I'll try to explain why, and please interrupt me. So I'm happy to take questions and comments and heckling as we go along. So here are some big ideas. One is that of a strongly software-independent voting system, which is due to Ron and John Wack. So a voting system is strongly software independent. If an undetected error or change to its software cannot produce an undetected change in the outcome, and we can find the correct outcome without rerunning the election. Okay, so you have to have a way to find out that something has gone wrong and a way to recover from that, right? You have the wherewithal to recover from it without doing a new election. So a risk-limiting audit, I get to claim as a big idea since you invited me to talk about it. It is an audit that has a large known chance of a full hand count if the outcome is wrong, thereby correcting the outcome. The point is that the hand count corrects things. I always use the word fix, and it's not a good word to use with elections. Corrects. Okay, the risk is the maximum chance that you fail to correct an apparent outcome that's wrong, no matter why it happened to be wrong. And so I talked, for those of you who were here an hour and a half ago, I talked about this notion of a resilient canvas framework, and I don't know whether it's a big idea or not, but maybe you guys can help me figure this out. So the idea is that it has a known minimum chance that the overall system, human, hardware, software, procedures, gives the right electoral outcome when it gives an outcome at all. Right? It has to have the ability to punt and say, you need to rerun the election because my record isn't accurate enough. So the idea is we combine a strongly software-independent voting system with a compliance audit to make sure that it sort of really is strongly software-independent, right? Verify that the audit trail would let you recover from a problem, and then do some procedure that figures out whether the count is accurate enough. Okay. So what do you need? Well, the voters have to create a complete, durable, accurate audit trail. You need this strongly software-independent voting system. You need the local elections official to curate the audit trail properly. You need proper use of seals, surveillance, secure chain of custody, all these sorts of things. We need a compliance audit to ensure that all of that stuff happened. And if the compliance audit can't demonstrate with some reasonable level of confidence, some reasonable evidentiary standard, that the audit trail really is intact, you need a revote. Right, and the absence of a smoking gun is not evidence, right? Okay, so one of the things we need as a technical matter, yes, John.
I just got confused on your last slide, on the last bullet.
Yeah, so the bullet out of the smoking gun, that one?
Before you start the audit, you do the audit.
Can you ask questions from the monitor?
Before you start the risk-limiting audit, you do a compliance audit.
Okay, so those are two separate audits?
Two separate audits. Compliance audit is... Compliance is to make sure that the audit trail is sufficiently accurate to determine the correct winner were you to count the whole thing.
And you have to define ahead of time what sufficient means.
Well, it actually would involve, I mean, yes. I mean, it will. Suppose that I lost a box of ballots, but that no matter how I count that box of ballots, the same person would have won. Then that's sufficiently accurate, right? So it doesn't need to be perfect, but it needs to be accurate enough. So so that if you counted what you have left, you'd know you got the right answer. And then the risk-limiting audit helps you figure out just how much of it do I have to count by hand. Okay, so one of the things we need as a technical matter is timely reporting of the all but final results for auditable batches. This is for almost every way of auditing. I'll talk about an exception to that. Smaller batches are better just in terms of efficiency. And then the risk-limiting part of it is to count votes by hand until there's strong evidence that counting the rest won't change the outcome. And explaining or resolving errors isn't enough. And a lot of audit laws worry about what was the cause of this error, and they sort of stop once they've explained it. And this became a really big deal in the New York Senate District 7 contest, where basically the judge was only going to count as a discrepancy anything that couldn't be explained. So an explanation of, oh, well, these ballots that went into the box didn't get scanned, that was fine. That's not a discrepancy. We know why it happened, right? Literally. Okay, so what are the red flags here for the elections officials, right? You might need a revote, and you might need to count all the votes by hand, even if you don't have a revote. With luck, neither of those things happens very often. Okay, so what's the status quo before risk-limiting audits? Does any state regulate how the audit trail is curated and checked prior to audit? I don't think California does. Does anybody say you must use seals in the following way? You must do ballot accounting. You must do this sort of thing. I mean, California. Sorry?
California requires seals.
Okay, California doesn't require ballot accounting, though, as far as I know. Yeah. So you can disappear a box or grow a box, but. Okay. So states that have audit laws generally have what. Paraphrasing Roger Johnson, I would call audit theater. The audits don't do a whole lot to ensure that the outcomes are correct. I mean, they do something, but they don't. But what they do is kind of orthogonal to ensuring that outcomes are correct. Okay, and there's a lot of hubbub over, you know, should your audit involve a flat percentage or have a sampling percentage that depends on the margin in some way? And this is all kind of sideways to verifying outcomes as well, because the issue is not how many ballots you need to count by hand initially. The issue is, when can you stop counting by hand? That's the important thing. When have you counted enough? Okay, so this is what California current law says. This is not the pilot law that does risk-limiting audits. I'll talk about that momentarily. It says, the official conducting the election shall conduct a public manual tally of the ballots tabulated by those devices, including absent voters' ballots cast in 1% of the precincts chosen at random by the elections official. The official conducting the election shall include a report on the results of the 1% manual tally in the certification of the official canvas of the vote. This report shall identify any discrepancies between the machine count and the manual tally, and a description of how each of these discrepancies was resolved. It doesn't say, if you see a big problem, you need to count more, or if your machine's obviously failed, you need to do this by hand, or anything. There's just sort of no follow. It's just like, say what you saw. Okay. Right? So there's no legal basis in this for somebody to say, you guys need to go count the record by hand, or something like that. Just count, look, explain, stop. All right, so what should audits do? Well, I think the first is sort of what current audits generally do. They're sort of the form count and stop or count and explain discrepancies, like California. And as a precursor, checking the integrity of the audit trail isn't really formalized or regulated, to the best of my knowledge, although you may know better than I do. There's two kinds of audits I want to talk about or think about. One is compliance audits. Were proper procedures followed? Was there secure chain of custody? Do we have sort of affirmative evidence that the audit trail itself is intact? Was this voting system as used, in fact, strongly software independent? Right? And then materiality audits, which are any errors that happened in spite of that, did they matter? Did they rise to the level of mattering for the outcome of the election? Okay, again, this is just rehashing compliance audit, which I've spoken about already, but, you know, did they follow procedures? These sorts of things should include ballot accounting, checks of seals, looking at surveillance tapes, things like that. If the compliance audit generates, you know, convincing affirmative evidence that a full hand count of the audit trail would give the right answer, then you go on to figure out whether you need to do a full hand count, right? But if not, you need to start over because you don't have strong enough evidence. That I claim, I assert. All right, so materiality audit, this is risk-limiting audits. This is what we're talking about now, which is, what's a material error for the point of view of voting? Well, it's an error that changed the outcome, right? From the point of view of the financial community, a material error is an error that would have caused somebody to make a different economic decision. And because it's very difficult to quantify what would cause a quote-unquote reasonable person to make a different economic decision, it's typically set at a 10% threshold. If it makes a 10% difference, it's material in the financial world. Otherwise, it's not, typically. All right, so fortunately in voting, we have a little crisper standard, which is, did it change the answer? Okay, so in order to do this materiality check, you need the audit trail. You need to know that the audit trail is good enough. If the materiality audit, you know, generates enough evidence that a full hand count is going to give you the same answer that you already have, you can stop. So you're going to keep counting until you have strong evidence. If you never get strong evidence, you end up doing a full count. And then you know what the right answer is. You know what the audit trail says, assuming that the audit trail is really intact. Okay, so now we're on the soup part of soup to nuts. If you want to know whether a batch of soup is too salty, you don't need to eat the whole batch, right? It's enough to taste a teaspoon of the soup if the soup has been stirred up well, right? So, and it doesn't really matter how big the pot is, a teaspoon is enough if you've stirred it up well. Okay, the same thing goes for elections, right? Election soup. Salt is like vote tabulation error, right? We have, if you want to know whether there's too much error, like too much salt, too much error is enough error to have changed the outcome of the contest, right? So to do that, you don't need to count all the votes, typically, generally. But the amount that you need to count depends on what qualifies as too salty, what qualifies as too much error. And too salty has to do with the margin, right? It's salty compared to the margin. And that doesn't depend on the number of ballots. It depends on, you know, like the dilution of the salt, the dilution of the errors. It's the concentration that matters somehow. All right, so the standard approach to auditing elections breaks things down into two pieces. The machines export some subtotals, and the first step is to check that if those subtotals were right, the winners are as they were named to be. Okay, so you're sort of checking the math, right? And the second step, so that sum should be, you know, perfect, right? If that sum isn't perfect, the there's a coding error in the vote tabulation system, right? It the data doesn't match. You know, arithmetic we're supposed to be able to do perfectly. Not me, but, you know, computers anyway. Okay, so the arithmetic ought to be perfect, but the data might not be, because the data that goes into it involves scanners reading voter mark paper ballots and things like that, and so there can be errors of interpretation that will cause the touchstone of a human reading of a paper ballot to differ from the machine's interpretation of the ballot as a cast vote record. So they don't need to be perfect, but they need to be accurate enough to determine who actually won. Of course, if we're talking about DREs, those results better be perfect. So this approach to auditing requires the vote tabulation system to reveal what it's adding at the same level of granularity that you're going to do the checking. So if it only reports things for precincts, then you have to check the level of precincts. If it could report subtotals or interpretations of individual ballots, you could check the level of individual ballots, and that's where we're trying to get. Okay, but not only do you need the reporting, you need to be able to match the relevant part of the audit trail to that subtotal. So you actually, it's not enough to sort of get a complete list. You have to know what paper goes with what subtotal. And that's a hard problem. it needn't be a hard problem, but it is in fact a hard problem with what we have to work with right now. Okay, so here's a different approach to auditing that is mind-numbingly simple. The basic idea is you draw a random sample of ballots, you interpret them by hand, and you extrapolate who won. And if you sort of make a confidence interval for the vote share, and at very high confidence this person won, that limits the risk the same way that another way of limiting the risk does too. The amount that you're going to have to count to get convincing evidence that the apparent winner is the true winner is going to depend on the true margin. Because if the margin is very close, it's going to take, you're going to have to look at an awful lot of ballots to be really, really sure that this person's share of the vote is, you know, 40.1% and not 40.05% where the second place is, right? Or something. I mean, it's going to, okay. So the cool thing about this is it's really independent of the voting system as long as you have a paper trail. You can do it with a quill and ink and dice and a piece of paper to write down subtotals and do some arithmetic, right? It's sort of the steampunk audit. Okay, the problem with this approach is that the sample size you need to do this extrapolation confidently grows enormously as the margin gets small. It's out of control compared to the other way of doing it, where you're measuring the error in the counts rather than trying to extrapolate the winner from the ballots. So it's much less efficient than the other approach, but it has the advantage of making essentially no demands on the voting system other than that you have a paper trail that you can sample from. We tried it in Monterey County in 2011, and Eva was present, if she's in the room now. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, so definitions, I think we talked about this already before, but you know, the audit trail of the ballot is supposed to be an indelible record of how the voters cast their votes, for example, voter mark paper or VVPATs by some stretch. The outcome of the contest is the set of winners. The apparent outcome is what the voting machine says the winners are. The correct outcome is what we would get if we counted the whole thing by hand. And the apparent outcome is wrong if it disagrees with what we would get if we did the whole thing by hand. And, okay, blah, 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 blah. All right. Okay, so what's a risk-limiting audit? It has this pre-specified minimum chance of correcting the apparent outcome if the apparent outcome is wrong. What's the risk? It's the largest possible chance that an apparent outcome that's wrong doesn't get caught and corrected, no matter why it's wrong. But again, remember, the definition of wrong here means disagrees with the paper. If the paper itself doesn't reflect what should have happened, this doesn't fix that, right? That's why we need the compliance audit as a first step. So simultaneous risk-limiting audits, you do more than one contest at the same time and still get a probabilistic guarantee that if one or more of the outcomes was wrong, you fix it. Okay. Okay, so risk-limiting audits. So risk-limiting audits are really, really easy. You want to have a big chance of correcting the outcome if it's wrong. No problem. Just count all the paper every time. You have 100% chance of correcting the outcome if the outcome is wrong. Okay, so we don't need a statistician to make a risk-limiting audit. What we need computer scientists and statisticians and other people for is to do it efficiently, right, so that you don't end up counting more paper than you need to confirm the outcome. So we want to minimize the amount of paper we touch when the outcome is right, and when the outcome is wrong, we want to touch all the paper. So that's sort of the goal. So risk-limiting audits, you know, a bunch of people have gotten behind the idea, and that's great because we actually now have states that are willing to do it, California being one of them, at least willing to do it on a pilot basis. So the definition of risk-limiting audit here, if I could, I would delete the words employing a statistical method, because that seems like it's just flowery language, it doesn't add anything. What we want is large predetermined chance of requiring a full tally, whatever full tally would show a different outcome, right? So it gets the guts of it right. The miracle in this is that it got unanimous bipartisan support in both houses, and we have 20 counties now committed to doing pilot audits under this law that passed last year. And we also have support from the EAC to help carry some of these out. Colorado passed a law that was even more ambitious because it's got, commencing in 2014, they're going to do risk-limiting audits. And here again, incorrect outcome is defined in a nice way, an outcome that's inconsistent with what you would get from a full hand count. And risk-limiting means
recount
here, not hand count. Yeah, recount. And our recount rules are different from hand count rules. Yeah. And in fact, the elections officials I've spoken with would be very, very happy to do a full hand count rather than a recount because, yeah. All right, and then the definition of risk-limiting audit, again, is somehow, it's got the right, it's very close. It's got the right flavor. You know, it's got the right words. Okay, what have we've done this, right? We've actually managed to do this in practice. The first one was in Marin County in February 2008. Then we did it again in Marin in November 2008 and in 2009. Again, this is thanks to Elaine Ginold's willingness to let me play in her backyard. Elaine was also on the post-election audit standards working group that David Jefferson chaired. Orange County did just this year. Yolo County, we've done a couple of audits there. Santa Cruz County, we've done one. Monterey County did one. What's next up is San Luis Obispo County next month. We're expecting four or five more counties to do pilots this November. We've done a variety of kinds of contests. We've done measures requiring a supermajority, simple measures, multi-candidate contests, contests where you get to vote for more than one person. We have not done IRV. We have not done contests that cross county lines. And we have not yet done more than one contest at the same time, but that's expected to happen in San Luis Obispo next month. We're going to do two at once. Contest sizes ranged from microscopic, 200 ballots, to about 121,000 ballots. The counting burden ranged from about 32 ballots to 7,000, and the cost per audited ballot ranged from nothing to about 55 cents per ballot. Okay. In Colorado, Neil has done a risk-limiting audit in Boulder County in November. We are expecting that three or four of the five Colorado counties that are participating in the EAC grant are going to do risk-limiting audits this November. So both California and Colorado have grants for this. I think I mentioned that already. Okay, so here's some pictures. This is the reason that some audits don't cost anything, because I go with a grad student and do the counting, right? That's from that's counting ballots in Yolo in 2008. We had a four-person counting board. We were doing a shout-out of the votes and tallying them. As an example, the tally sheets we used, sort of the same thing that they would have used to do their 1% statutory audit. this is the ballot that we have found in all of this that was misinterpreted by the voting system. And what happened here was that the stickum from the envelope stuck to the ballot face of a vote-by-mail ballot. When the envelope was opened, it tore the voter's mark in half. And the way that Yolo and some other counties do the work, Yolo is a beautiful example. Any time that there is an undervote reported on a ballot in their central count optical scan, an operator looks at the image of the front page of the ballot. And if that front page has generally dark marks, the operator just passes the ballot and figures that it was a deliberate undervote. If it has light marks, then the operator looks at the specific contest in question to determine whether it's a deliberate undervote or not. And in this case, the voters' marks were generally dark, so the operator didn't look at this particular contest on that ballot, and it went through and counted as an undervote. This is my favorite. That's a very emphatic undervote. The range of voters' marks is enormous, and yet, used properly, these central count scanners can do a remarkable job of counting them correctly. I mean, here we've got a mark that's kind of all over the place. There, a tiny little X that's mostly not in the spot. This is a nice, this ballot shouldn't be valid because there's an identifying mark, but the voter wrote that on the ballot. Neatness counts, right? It's like perfectly filled out mark. And then this is a very emphatic vote. We've got it filled in and X'd up. Okay. All right. This was the first audit that we did under the new pilot law in California. This was in Orange County, these are the machines, the DREs that were used in the audit, just here stored in a bunch of racks. In order to do the audit, because of the way Orange County downloaded the data in the first place, it was necessary to go hook every machine back up to the, somebody remind me what this is called, the software that Hart uses to sort of talk to the individual DREs. Yeah, that stuff. Yeah, right. Okay. So it was necessary to hook all the machines up just to sort of find out how many votes were tabulated on the machine and to get the, how many votes were tabulated was already known, but the sort of specific subtotals for that machine, they had to be hooked up again to download that. So that took something like an hour and a half or 2 hours of a technician's time as a prelude to conducting the actual audit, just getting the data out. This is an example of VVPAT rolls and the machines that generate them. This is the four-person counting board that went through and counted the VVPAT rolls for this audit. Every jurisdiction has a different ingenious way of dealing with these terrible rolls of paper. They built this sort of scrolling device that allows them to use it like a Torah and move it from one scroll onto another. this particular audit was kind of interesting. It was a hybrid where part of it was done at the ballot level, looking at individual ballots, and part of it, the votes cast on DREs were audited at the machine level by looking at the VVPATs for the machine. So the way that we were able to locate individual ballots in order to compare a hand-eye interpretation with the cast vote record according to the machine came from the fact that there's a non-unique serial number there on the ballots in Orange County, the number 1 to 2500, and they start again. And the intersection of those serial numbers with a precinct tends to produce something that's almost unique, despite the fact that ballots aren't supposed to be identifiable in California. So I'm a little bit confused about how all this stuff is legal. But at any rate, We were able to scan a barcode on the ballot, figure out what ballot image that was supposed to be, line up the picture of the ballot on the screen with the actual physical ballot, confirm that, yeah, that really does look like it's the same, you know, excursion, so forth and so on, so we're confident we have the same piece of paper, and then infer the CBR from the fact that the Hart Ballot Now software actually highlights this. It's subliminal here, but this box is highlighted, so we know that that's what that's the CBR that the machine has committed to. Okay, this is now going into the Monterey audit. Let me just back up. That Orange County audit was missing an important piece. We were not able to get all of the subtotals out in order to check the addition, right? Remember, I mentioned that audits typically have two pieces. One is check that it added the column of numbers right, and then check that the numbers in the column are right, right? So the first thing is supposed to be an exhaustive thing. You do the math, and we weren't able to get all the numbers out of the machines to check the math. We were able to check that the numbers that were added were sufficiently accurate on the assumption that it did the addition correctly. Okay, for the Monterey audit, this was the steampunk audit where we had originally intended to audit at the ballot level using Mitch Trachtenberg's TEVS software and had done a bunch of preliminary work to get TEVS to swallow Sequoia ballots and build ballot definition files for TEVS that matched this. Anyway, we did a lot of work, and then on the day of, when it came time to process all of the scanned ballots, it failed to process about 10% of the ballots. And so that was not going to work for an audit, and we needed to go to Plan B. Plan B turned out to be the steampunk audit, where what we did is the numbers, the jurisdiction had actually used a bait stamp. That's one of these stamps that advances by one every time you stamp, so it puts a serial number on things mechanically. They had hand-stamped every ballot with a serial number. We knew exactly how many ballots there were. They were organized in a particular way, and I was able to say, okay, show me ballot number 117. And, okay, we looked at ballot 117, and it's a vote for so-and-so. Okay, put one in this column. Okay, show me ballot number 2047. Okay, here it is. Okay, that's a vote for so-and-so. We hold it up. We had a couple of observers from the public in the room, and everybody agreed on the interpretation of the ballot. We kept doing that until we had high statistical confidence that the person who was reported to be the winner was in fact the winner. That is, that counting the rest of the ballots wouldn't have changed the outcome. So this is the 10-sided die that we used. We took turns rolling the die to generate seed in a random number generator. This is an example of, you know, looking at a particular ballot and interpreting that as a mark for Brenda Lewis. Okay, this is, we laid out the ballots all on a table so that anybody in the room could look at them and check the interpretation. okay, so it ended up being sort of two rows of ballots, you know, so forth and so on. It was kind of a big mess. These are, I guess you can see that these are, this is three rows, right? These are stacked. I don't think I even put in any numbers here, but let's talk about, but it ended up, that audit involved looking at on the order of 90-some-odd ballots to confirm the outcome, selected at random from a pile of, if I remember right, between 2 and 3,000.
The margin was
large. If the margin had been small, it would have been bad. Yeah. It grows roughly like the reciprocal of the square for that style of auditing. Okay, so now we're gone from soup to jelly beans. Want to explain why batch size matters. So imagine that we have 100 bags, each of which has 100 jelly beans in it, various flavors. We want to know what fraction of the jelly beans in all are coconut. So the thing to think about is a coconut jelly bean represents an error in a vote, that an error in the interpretation of a ballot that caused the that inflated the apparent winner's count. It's an overstatement of the margin error, right? Those are the kind of errors that could have created the false impression that somebody won when they didn't win. So estimating the fraction of coconut jelly beans is like estimating the error rate in the election. Okay, so one way that you might try to do that without counting all of the jelly beans is to pull a bag at random from this pile of 100 bags and count the coconut jelly beans in that bag. okay? That gives you an estimate that is statistically unbiased, right? This is a nice thing. Statisticians like unbiased estimates. But the uncertainty in that estimate is actually quite large compared to doing a different experiment, which is open all the bags, pour all the jelly beans together in a big pot, stir them up, and pull 100 jelly beans out of the stirred pot. Okay? That breaks down these barriers between the bags, which is like breaking down the barriers between precincts. Okay, so instead of getting one precinct worth, one batch worth of ballots and counting them, it's much, much better to stir all of the votes together and pull ballots at random from the entire contest. Okay, so the sampling variability associated with the estimate that you would get from counting 100 beans chosen at random from all the beans is much, much, much lower than the uncertainty that you get if you pull one bag of beans and count the 100 beans in that bag. You could have some bags that are entirely coconut, some bags that are sours and no coconut. Oh, when you mix them all together, that kind of problem goes away. It becomes much more homogeneous. You get a much more reliable estimate for the same counting work. Now, the process of opening the bags and putting them together and stirring them, we're kind of ignoring that cost of the procedure. But at any rate.
It's not a cost because to detect a coconut jelly bean and distinguish it from vanilla and sour, you have to eat it.
Yeah. We call this destructive testing in the lingo. Yes. Okay. All right. So among the advantages of doing risk-limiting audits at the ballot level, it's like mixing everything together. You get much more bang for the buck, as it were, for the jelly bean. So it's relatively cheap if the technology supports it. And this is a real issue, and I want to get into this in detail because I have a huge plea for help. It's relatively fast and much more observable. As I mentioned in the SOBA talk, it's much easier to sort of to say, here's a ballot. Who do you think it's a vote for? Here's the cast vote record for that ballot. Do they agree? Than to try to watch a big group of people with huge stacks of ballots counting things up when even the people who are doing the counting very often make mistakes. I've been part of one of these four-person boards, and you know, you end up disagreeing with a person sitting right next to you counting the same ballots from the same shout-out, right? It's just very difficult to keep track of things in large numbers. Counting from 0 to 1, computers are very good at it. We're actually pretty good at counting from 0 to 1. We're much less good at counting from 0 to 1,000, right? The computations are actually quite easy compared to the computations if you audit at the batch level, the statistics that you have to do. The way that you do the sampling to get relatively efficient audits is relatively simple. If you sample every ballot with the same probability, that really works pretty well. Whereas if you're sampling bigger batches of ballots, there's huge payoff from adjusting your sampling probabilities so you have a bigger chance of sampling the batches that can hold more error. And that gets much more difficult to explain to people and more difficult to implement. So we've tested this a few times. Expecting to do this in San Luis Obispo next month, expecting to do this for a contest that crosses jurisdictions in 2012, and we're hoping to do ballot level audits in at least 15 California jurisdictions and 5 Colorado jurisdictions in 2012. We'll see what happens. So I'm going to go back now to the Orange County statutory audit, which was the one that was sort of a hybrid between using the VVPATs from the machines and the images of the ballots and the ballots and the physical ballots for the votes that came in by mail. So the statutory audit for that, the 1% audit that California requires, involved counting one precinct by hand, and it didn't find any errors. Okay, so how much confidence should that give us in the outcome of the election? And the answer is not very much, right? That basically there are ways of hiding error so that there'd be over an 88% chance that the audit wouldn't find a single mistake even if the outcome was wrong. And this is kind of what I was trying to say to David Dill earlier, that sort of the statutory audit isn't hard to defeat. It defeats itself, right? So the error rate in the sample doesn't say a lot about the error rate in the whole contest because precincts are so big, right? If you the same number of ballots drawn individually rather than drawn as a group would give a whole lot more confidence. Just like drawing one bag, you might get a bag with no coconut jelly beans, as opposed to if you stir them up, you're likely to get a much more representative sample. Okay, oops, what happened to my next page? All right, so, in contrast, the risk-limiting audit had a 90% chance of progressing to a full hand count if the outcome of the contest was wrong, Okay, so when it signs off and says we're done, you give some kind of a statistical guarantee, if that's not an oxymoron, that you got the right answer. How do the costs compare? So the statutory audit cost about $260. The cost scales with the size of the contest because the number of ballots you have to look at is 1%, right? No matter how big the contest gets, a contest that was twice as large would have cost about twice as much to audit. The risk-limiting audit that we did at the 10% risk level cost almost $500. Of course, that values me at my market rate, zero. But it would have cost essentially the same for any contest that had the same margin as a percentage, no matter how large the contest was. So we wouldn't have had to look at more ballots if the margin was about the same, assuming we didn't find big errors or something like that. But things are operating normally. It scales very nicely. That is, it's constant. It's a very good way to scale. Okay, so it's again this idea that you only need to taste a teaspoon of soup to tell if it's too salty, no matter how big the pot is. Right? You look at it roughly the same number of ballots, depending on the margin. The margin tells you, gives you an idea of what would constitute being too salty. Okay, so now I'm really going to be talking about stuff I don't know anything about, and I'm prepared to be shot down. But I want to take a rather extreme position that we're regulating almost exactly the wrong thing. Ron will correct me, and other people here know more about what's going on with machine certification than I do and exactly what's required, but we're regulating the voting technology instead of regulating the outcome accuracy, right? What we want to do is regulate the outcome accuracy. So what do we have? We've got, you know, in some states we have these ad hoc audits of fixed percentages of ballots, no sensible rule for requiring more ballots to be counted. And that's where we have audits at all, right? In most places, we don't have audits. In many places, we don't have audits. Okay, what do I think we need? I think we need to certify the procedures that are used for creating, curating, and auditing the audit trail, right? We need to be regulating the use of seals, surveillance, things to ensure proper chain of custody, ballot accounting, and the audit stage. So what we need to know about the machines is that they generate a reliable, complete audit trail. That's what we need to know about the machines. We also need to know that they're usable. We need to know there are other things that clearly matter, but these should be some of functional requirements, right? And there are probably more ways to meet the functional requirements than to have the vendors doing what they're doing now. Okay, what else do we need? We need standards for data exchange formats. We don't have them, right? I mean, there are bodies that are trying to develop them, but we don't have anybody who's required to use them, right? So because nobody's required to use them, we have a lot of trouble when you want to even get the data out of the vote tabulation system in order to start the audit, to get the data you need to do the auditing. If you want to start auditing contests that are happening in more than one jurisdiction, statewide, nationwide, it becomes more and more important to have data exchange, you know, some common data format that you can deal with. What do we need? We need the latest, cheapest, most accurate technology for counting and auditing. That is kind of built out of the system. We need evidence-driven rules that require a revote if you can't show that the audit trail is going to be accurate enough to tell you the answer. And then we need evidence-driven rules that require counting the whole audit trail if the machine count isn't accurate enough. So that's sort of the risk-limiting audit piece. I claim that the incentives of the current system are in the wrong place, right? That certification really gets in the way. It's an economic barrier to entry for other people to develop systems. It results in expensive maintenance contracts for proprietary systems, proprietary data formats, onerous contracts between the local elections officials, the local jurisdictions, and the vendors. We don't end up owning the data that were generated by our elections, so forth and so on. So I think this really favors the vendors more than it favors the jurisdictions or the voters. If instead what we told the local elections officials they had to do was not, you don't have to use this piece of equipment, you have to demonstrate strong enough evidence that you got the right answer. And to some extent, how you do that is up to you, right? Then they would have an incentive to buy, build, use the most accurate system that lets them confirm the outcome with the least work, the least manual work. But they still have to confirm it, right? It's not just a question of, we bought a really accurate technology, we're done. We bought a really accurate technology, so it actually, we don't have to audit very much because we never find errors. Right, so we know that we got the right answer when we do that. Okay, so those things I think could be relatively inexpensive compared to what we're generally locked into now, and instead this sort of whole certification, the length of time that it takes, the difficulty in putting changes through and whatnot, lead to opacity, right? Because we don't have disclosed source. We don't know how this stuff works. There's no incentive for a local elections official to reveal a lot of intermediate results because they don't have to show that they got the right answer in some sense. So whereas if they have to show that they got it right step by step, then that is transparency in some sense. Okay, and then there's a huge disincentive to upgrading the technology, even if there's something more accurate out there, because it's just expensive. All right, so the difference between theory and practice is smaller in theory than it is in practice. this is not mine. I really wish it were. It's brilliant. So what are some of the problems that we've run into in actually trying to do this? So one is the enormous variety of voting systems that are in place, even within individual states. So trying to come up with something that exploits any special characteristics of the voting system becomes very difficult because it needs so many flavors of it. Most of the voting systems that we have don't support efficient auditing because they don't generate or export or allow you to associate CVRs with physical ballots. Another problem we have, I'm sort of having trouble scrolling here. I should maybe try an arrow. Does an arrow work? Ooh, it does. How about that? Building production systems is not academic research, right? I don't have any funding for this stuff generally, right? But certainly, if you wanted to build a system that would allow you to put in a ballot and create a cast vote record for it, doing it once in a breadboard in Python or MATLAB or something is research. But making a tool that people can actually go out there and use every day to conduct election audits is not research. And it's very, very difficult to get it funded. And so there's also no academic incentive for PhD students to work on it because it isn't research. So it is as an example of a failure. John Arntz, the San Francisco Registrar of Voters, was perfectly willing for us to come in and do a risk limiting audit of his IRV mayoral contest in November, right? Would have been the first IRV audit, risk limiting IRV audit, assuming that I could have gotten software from Ron or somebody else here or Tom to make it fly for computing the margin. But what's the rub? Well, it pretty much has to be done at the ballot level. You can't do it at the precinct level, partly because the margin that's expected is so small that you really, he said he would be lucky to get a 1,000 vote margin in effect out of 240,000 votes expected turnout. Okay, so that basically means you got to rescan all the ballots. So it's 240,000 ballots, two pages each, 480,000 pieces of paper. It's not just generic pieces of paper, it's 110-pound cardstock in a 10-inch by 20-inch format. Okay, so you get a machine, what's the fastest throughput you can get for 110-pound paper, 10 by 20-inch format? It turns out that there are some 220-page-per-minute scanners that will do that at roughly 200 to 300 dots per inch, which is kind of what you need to be able to make this fly, if we have the software to interpret the marks. But before we even get there, you know, what's the actual burden of this? Well, I spoke to some people who rent this kind of equipment, and they basically said that we would need 25 to 30 people operating three machines to do this in 2 days. we would need room to put them, which San Francisco doesn't have, you know, secure room controlled by them so they keep control of their ballots, so forth and so on. And the machine rental actually isn't as bad as the price tag looks. We could have rented the machines for maybe $3,000, $3,500 for a week. But the machines cost, if a jurisdiction wanted to buy them, like $70,000. But now, okay, so this raises this issue of built-in versus bolt-on audits. So in a small jurisdiction, you can do a bolt-on audit, where you sort of have something you do after the fact to get the risk-limiting audit out of it. For a large jurisdiction, it really needs to be built into the workflow. There are a number of times when they touch all the paper, where they could be capturing a digital image of it that could then be used to extract a cast vote record to do a transitive audit from the parallel scan. For example, one stage, they physically count the pieces of paper that are there, not count the marks on them, but count the pieces of paper. That's part of their ballot accounting. So if that counting function were done by a scanner rather than by a paper picker, you could capture an image at the same time. Okay, so what do we need? We need voting systems that produce cast vote records linked to ballots. The voting system should commit to its interpretation of each ballot. Thank you. We need good regulations, practices, and audits to get evidence that the audit trail is intact before we start doing the risk-limiting audit, the materiality audit. We need a willingness to have a revote if there isn't enough evidence that the audit trail is reliable. we need a willingness to have a full hand count if there isn't enough evidence that the machine's got an accurate enough result from the paper. And we need good ways to explain what we do and why we do it. We need good education, public relations outreach. So technical needs, this is the last thing I'll try to explain. We need data exchange formats, as I said. We need things like uniform naming conventions for contests and candidates across jurisdictions. I mean, how do you start auditing a statewide race if you don't have the same sort of underlying, okay. We need data plumbing that allows prompt statewide reporting that's adequate to support audits. So we need to be able to draw a sample from on high. We need jurisdictional cooperation if we're going to start auditing contests that cross jurisdictional boundaries. And we need methods to audit ballot manifests. So we need to have a way to say, okay, here's all the paper from my election. This is bag one, it has 17 pieces of paper. This is bag two, it has 135 pieces of paper. We need some way to sort of audit that assertion that this is what the bags contain. And I have some ideas about how to do that and how to build it into a risk limiting audit a la SOBA so that the same sample could confirm, you know, that the mapping is right, that the interpretation of the ballots is right, and that you have as much paper as you're supposed to have. Okay. Meanwhile, we also need stopgap measures until the voting systems have come out in the next generation and people are willing to pay for them. So the next generation of Dominion voting systems should be very, very good for auditing because it really does associate a cast vote record with every piece of paper in a way that you can make the association. But there aren't any in California, and I think they're still pending federal certification. Okay. If anybody has any idea of how to raise money, raise volunteers, raise something to build software that would do the following, this is the nut we need to crack. This is one more nut. Okay. We got to be able to describe a ballot, tell the software where to look for the voter's marks and what the voter's mark means. Then we have to be able to take an image of the ballot and figure out, is there a mark in this place or not? Okay, and this needs to be done in a way, in a tool that elections officials can actually use. Okay, so just back to the nuts one more time. What are election officials afraid of, right? Because if our fears are close, then we're mutually non-nuts. If our fears are far apart, we're mutually nuts. So I don't know. I'm pretty sure that they don't worry about somebody hacking the software in a scanner to spoof something. But I think that they'd fear that, you know, their printer doesn't deliver the ballots on time. There's a fire in the warehouse. The volunteers don't show up on election day. Some massive hardware failure. Cars crash with the ballots on board. Recounts, big fear, right? That they don't finish the canvas on time. And I think that makes us nuts, mostly to the elections officials. Thanks a lot.
No, there it is. Okay. So the one thing that struck me, I realized only as you were talking about it, the parallels between this and end-to-end verifiability, which after all really is just a form of audit as well.
Yep.
There are many close parallels, and the thing that I noticed the most was your plea to confirm outcomes rather than confirming the equipment and the methods. The same thing that happens with E2E, and Peter earlier was kind enough to credit me with going around with the rant of saying we're certifying equipment with E2E, we should be certifying elections. And
great, now I know whom to quote. Okay.
this has been a problem because it's a paradigm shift, mm-hmm. and election officials are often in a box and saying, but we have to certify, qualify the equipment. We have no choice. We don't have this flexibility. Do you have any insights into how to sort of change the paradigm, change the rules? You know, how do we make progress there?
Well, I mean, we have friendly elections officials both at the local and state level. And I think are states free to use uncertified equipment if they give up half the money? Is that basically the rub?
It depends on the state. States have different rules.
Ana Maria Quevedo, I have a question on your audit that you have 2 days to audit an entire ballot stock. You have a system that will recognize a handwritten write-in candidate and tally those who are certified write-ins, considering you have 2 days for it?
So would that allow us to identify the handwritten? No, it would the point would be those ballots would be identified as having a write-in candidate on them, right? And I would probably end up pooling all the write-in candidates together for the sake of the audit, on the assumption that there aren't enough of them to even pool together to potentially win. If that's a false assumption, then I would need something like the system that you were working on to sort of identify the candidates automatically, at least put them in piles in some way. But what I was hoping we could do was at least create a cast vote record for each piece of paper and associate with the piece of paper, and that cast vote record in the case of a write-in would say write-in.
Paul Miller, election official for 22 years and also a member of the TPDC with Doug Jones and Ron Rivest. So I think just speaking, there's a lot more interest on the TGDC in auditing than there used to be, and I think that's a rightly placed emphasis. Is this better? Okay, I guess I need to get closer to it. As an election official, I had a question about the risk limiting audit. And it still gets back to that question of how many ballots is enough ballots to, and I was wondering what the impact of having a large number of contests on a ballot, where the range of the number of participants in that contest can range from a countywide election with 800,000 voters to a very small election where you have maybe 100 voters. Mm-hmm. How that impacts how many ballots you would be.
I'll give you a rough worst case scenario and then sort of a happy scenario. So first of all, the number of ballots you have to look at depends enormously on the batch size. And if you can audit at the ballot level, if you're able to do that by using a separate scan or if you have equipment that supports it, then if you wanted to audit at 10% risk, you know, sort of 90% confidence, that number, that magic number I gave earlier today, sort of 7 divided by the margin, that's how many ballots. If you start by looking at that and you don't find any ballots that overstated a margin by 2, meaning you don't have any ballots where it said it was a vote for the apparent winner, but in fact it was a vote for the apparent loser. So the thinking behind this is, it seems much more plausible that when the machines are operating correctly, a vote for a candidate might be mistaken as an undervote or vice versa. A stray mark might turn something from a vote into an overvote or something like that. But actually flopping, turning a vote for one person into a vote for somebody else, should be pretty unlikely if things are working properly. So let's assume we don't see that. We only see one vote shifts. Then if the percentage of one vote shifts is no bigger than a fifth of the margin, you can stop with that rule. Start by looking at 7 over the margin. If you don't see more than an error rate that's more than 20% of the margin, you can stop. If you see an error rate that's bigger than that, you're going to have to go on to try to confirm that despite the fact that there's some error, the outcome is right. And the amount by which you need to go on is going to depend on the actual error rate in the contest. Now, on the sort of having a lot of contests that have overlapping geography, some large number of voters and some smaller number of others, the worst case scenario would be you look at that many ballots per contest and you audit them separately in some sense. So you take your little bitty contests that might have a large margin for the little bitty contest, large percentage margin for the little bitty contest, and maybe you only need to look at 6 or 8 or 10 ballots for that if the margin is 30%. You know, but if for those where the margin, 7 divided by 0.3 would be 21 ballots roughly, right? Something like that, on the order of 20 ballots. So, but then if you have a large contest with a very, very small margin, you'd be drawing a relatively large number of ballots. But still, if you have a margin on the order of 0.5%, do you have an automatic recount law where you're?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Where does that kick in?
Machine counts part at 0.5 and then
But if the margin is small, do you have an automatic recount below 0.25% or 0.5% or something like that?
Yeah, that's
right. That wasn't error rate. That was margin. Okay.
The margin between the top two candidates.
Okay.
Okay,
so 0.5%, which is your threshold there, right, would be looking at 2,000 ballots. So at your threshold, your sample size is 2,000 ballots, and if you don't see big problems, you stop. Below that, you're forced to do an automatic hand count anyway. So it's sort of 2,000 ballots per contest, worst case. Better case, if you have overlap and the larger percentage margins are in the smaller contests, you can start to do things simultaneously and cut down on that burden by auditing more than one contest at once.
Steve Checkaway, UC San Diego. I was wondering what the bottleneck is in doing this in the counting, because it seems like you could get a 99% confidence that you were right by just counting twice the number of ballots.
The confidence level increases really quickly with the sample size. 10% was utterly pulled out of a hat for the purpose of the pilots. Did I just say that? No, I did the calculation. It was 7 divided by 0.5%. And somehow I turned that into 2,000. I don't know how I did that. But that's about 1,500, 1,400. Yeah, okay. Yes, absolutely. For the purpose of the pilots, it's really just to kick the tires and make sure that everything works. But a little bit larger sample size will buy you a lot more confidence, absolutely. Yeah. Assuming you don't find problems. Yeah.
Standing on tiptoes here. Philip, in 2008, we did a study, several groups did a study called Is America Ready to Vote? And one of the measures that we examined was about ballot accounting and reconciliation. And we're looking at redoing it potentially for 2012. So the measures that we looked at had to do with, you know, whether they'd counted for all the ballots and the numbers of votes of voters at the polling place and so on, which goes somewhat to your compliance audit standards. And we found that 8 states did enough to get a good rating, that everyone did something.
I'm encouraged.
9 states were, you know, kind of in the bad category, needs improvement. And some were generally good, but only 8 were doing kind of enough to be ranked in there. So that may have changed since then. You know, and some of them had good rules but weren't doing everything that was in the rules, so it was a little tricky to measure. But if there are specific things that we can work together on to identify, we could potentially expand that.
Well, I think I'm hoping that in our legislative language group we can start to flesh out what we think we should have. So thank you.
Hi, Jeremy Epstein, SRI International. First, a comment that there's at least one example of a state that has extremely clear audit laws that would be unchallengeable, and that is Virginia. Audits are illegal. And so
that's clarity. That's nice. Clear. Yes, we like clarity.
But seriously, I was curious.
See, Florida's almost as clear, right? At most one? Yeah, okay.
What I'm wondering is your thoughts on, you had presented the language of the California law for risk limiting audits, and then later on you presented this 7 over the margin, and I'm wondering whether, from a policy perspective, embedding the 7 over the margin or full recount if that fails is a better way, because it's extremely concrete and you can explain to someone this is what it means instead of trying to do this mumbo jumbo.
So first of all, the 7 over the margin presumes that you can audit at the ballot level, and the technology might not support that. But my bias is actually towards legislating the principles and leaving the implementation details to regulation, so that if somebody comes up with a much better approach, you can adopt it immediately. Or if somebody discovers that my proof is faulty, you can abandon it immediately. That said, I know that the political climates are very different in different states, and there are states like New Mexico, which put through an audit law that was, you know, largely based on the premise that the voters didn't trust the election officials to do the right thing, so they wanted to tie their hands to do something, right? And that seems to be common, not universal. So I think that maybe large states and small states could be different, where a smaller state where you could afford to do top-down sampling, everything at once, legislate, you know, something very close to a rule for how to do it. Bigger states that are have a lot of autonomous counties like California, more complicated, maybe better to legislate principles, and then have a safe harbor method that, you know, if the local election official uses the following method, then they're okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for that.